and welcome to Mapping the Zone, a podcast normally dedicated to discussing the work and context of Thomas Pynchon. And this is a special bonus episode that I didn't really want to have to record, but it kind of has to happen. For anyone who somehow doesn't know, filmmaker and artist David Lynch passed away on the 16th yesterday. And so Kate and I decided that we would take some time to discuss his work, as it's been highly influential for both of us. And I don't think there's ever been a filmmaker like him, and I really don't think there will ever be another one like him. Mm-hmm. So I think it would just be fun to kind of talk about what his work meant to us and kind of go through his filmography and discuss those films and just kind of have a light conversation, and hopefully people listening, if you've never watched his films, can find a place to jump in. And if you have, and maybe you've missed one or you want to go back and rewatch them, hopefully this will kind of help you on that journey.
Yeah, I think I think starting with what we both think is the best entry point into his films are, that's probably the question that if there's anyone listening who hasn't watched his stuff is going to be at the forefront of their mind. That's a difficult place to know where to go when you're looking at what his filmography just looks like.
Yeah, let's back it up a little bit from there and kind of talk about what makes his films Lynchian, because I know that's a that's a phrase that we've thrown around on this podcast a lot. Mm-hmm. And there may be people who aren't really too familiar with his style, such as it is, and what makes his films unique. So I think really the best way I can describe his work is it is beautifully dark. It is disjointed, but in a way that is not displeasing to watch. It is a really interesting balance of grotesque and beautiful and hurt and beauty and every kind of contrasting emotion that you can kind of have. And it's done in a very unique visual style. He tends to have these extreme kind of close-ups that make a situation that is normally uncomfortable to begin with even more so. He has really interesting camera work that will have these sort of shifting, jumpy edits or just real shaky camera work to add this sort of, you know, otherworldly or disorienting sort of feeling to what he's doing. Sound is huge for him. He really knows how to use sound in a film to a very good degree. And his music choice ties into that as well. His films always have amazing soundtracks. And he's up there with Pynchon for me as far as a quirky, irreverent sense of humor. It's something else, and it's really hard to kind of describe his humor. It's easier just to watch some of his stuff and let it wash over you. But that's what I think makes something kind of Lynchian for me. I don't know about you.
I think that the way that I would best describe his stuff, if someone was to ask me in just like an elevator pitch, would be something along the lines of his movies feel like you feel when you're dreaming. He really captured that, I guess, vibe or atmosphere where everything is realistic enough, but is just slightly off. And you have these sort of random moments of, like you're talking about, dread or just strange characters that appear and then disappear, that adds the additional element of an understanding that either it isn't reality or it's something just south of reality. But he was able to balance that in a really great way with still indicating to the audience what all of those elements meant. Like, you never necessarily had no clue what he was commenting on or comparing those things to. So in that way, it was truly a use of dream logic with these strange elements, but still conforming to like an internal logic that the viewer can follow. It's very impressive stuff, but I would say that would be the biggest thing that stands out to me as far as what separates his work from a lot of other people's work and what is uniquely sort of unquantifiable about it, at least to me anyway.
Yeah, the dream aspect of that is very big. That's a a recurring theme in almost all of his work, mm-hmm. and plays a large part in how his plots are set up. I think your description of that, of it feeling like a dream, is very accurate. I remember the first time I watched Eraserhead, I think it was my freshman year of college, and my roommate, I remember walking out of my room. It was like 1 a.m., I think, when I finished it. And I walked out of my room, and my roommate was like, he could tell something was up. He's like, what's wrong? I was like, I think I just watched a nightmare happen, and I don't know how to describe it other than that. It's his films are really, really interesting. And like I said earlier, there's really no one like him. There are people who influenced him, obviously, and people who have been influenced by him. But I don't think anyone really comes close to, you know, lumping everything together that he's able to do into his films and his art. So
one of my favorite associations to Eraserhead in my head isn't even like the first time I watched it, even though that is a huge one, obviously. It was that I was in a staff meeting that I was leading with some other people that I worked with, and they were talking about, one of the new people that we had just hired was talking about how they always need background music playing in order to like focus on anything. And so they were asking if we could put on like lo-fi hip hop beats or just like industrial sounds, just something in the background. And I was like, oh, you want me to put on the Eraserhead soundtrack?
I have just the ticket for that.
And then proceeded to do that. And it did indeed play for a solid 15 minutes of the meeting before one of the people that I was presenting this project to just like burst out laughing. And she's like, are we just going to leave that running? And it was as if everyone else in the room had forgotten that it was actually playing other than her. Yeah, that's probably my favorite memory associated with Eraserhead.
That's great. Yeah, I've listened to that soundtrack quite a bit. It's
crazy.
It's pretty interesting for sure. Well, so what do you think is a good jumping off point for someone who's new to his work? Where would you tell them to start?
I think you kind of have two choices in my mind. Like, do you want to go like for straight dope, no filters, David Lynch, or do you want to go for potentially like more mundane David Lynch? And if you're going for the more mundane route, I would probably actually pick The Elephant Man, his second feature-length movie, which still has some strange elements to it in the way that it's filmed and still gives you like a taste of some of his, you know, particular camera work or shot compositions that are unique to him. And it does kind of have a bit of an odd edge to it, but it is more or less a straight biography of the Elephant Man. I forgot his actual name.
Joseph Merrick.
Yes. And is like a very serious, very well-directed drama that was financed by Mel Brooks, of all people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a very strange story.
He saw Eraserhead and thought it was great.
And thought,
somehow thought,
that's the guy.
I know who's perfect for
that's
this.
That's the guy for The Elephant Man. But, it, you know, that will take you over to the side of Lynch, like that movie or like The Straight Story, which is a G-rated David Lynch movie.
Disney film.
Or, you know, the other kind of non-really Lynchian stuff that he did. Wild at Heart is sort of in the middle between the non-Lynchy stuff and the really Lynchy stuff, and then you have like Dune, which is just more of a curiosity than anything else. If you want to start with the like really David Lynch movies, the straight, you know, no filter, that would be Blue Velvet for me. Blue Velvet is an easy one to digest as far as the thematic intent behind it. It is still difficult in that there are some tough scenes in that movie to watch.
Yeah.
And it really blends reality with the feeling of being in like a nightmare or a night terror. The way that just everything seems just slightly off, but it still is more or less a noir story, but just sort of cranked up to 11 while providing a very effective social commentary on America and its veneer versus its reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's probably the best place to start in my mind for either end of his filmography. What do you think?
I would say I agree with you on the Elephant Man. I definitely think that for someone who is, for someone who's not used to unconventional storytelling and who might be uncomfortable with the really kind of grotesque stuff that comes into some of his other work, Elephant Man is probably the best place to start. It is still, there is still some grotesque imagery just by nature of what it is about. Joseph Merrick's condition was a really painful thing for him, both physically and mentally, to deal with. But that film also has a side of Lynch that I don't think gets talked about enough, which is the heart and passion that he has for characters. That movie, I think, in the hands of a lot of other directors, would have come off as making more of a curiosity of Merrick and not really giving him the emotional core and the heart that Lynch gave him throughout that film. It's a hard one to watch just because you watch this man suffer at the hands of all these other people who are ridiculing him and just putting him through hell, and all he wants is to just live his life. But yeah, it's a straightforward narrative. It's relatively short for Lynch. It's only 2 hours. It's got some amazing performances. Anthony Hopkins was great. John Hurt plays Joseph Merrick. He's phenomenal. That is also, I believe, the movie that he got the most Oscar nominations for. I want to say he got like 7 or 8, something like that. He got a lot, never won, which was ridiculous. So that's, I would say if you're not really, if you've never watched any of his stuff before and you're not really used to those kind of things, start there. I would say a step from that, if not The Straight Story, because The Straight Story, like you mentioned, is a G-rated Disney film, which is a phenomenal story. And we'll get to that when we get to it. But that's another good starting point. But it's completely unlike anything else in his filmography. So I don't think it really represents a lot of his other work. It has its Lynchian aspects, but it doesn't really feel as Lynchian as everything else he's done. I would say Blue Velvet is a good starting point if you are, if you're good with, you know, really disturbing imagery, very dark characters, a lot of violence, and an antagonist played by Dennis Hopper, who is absolutely unhinged and one of the greatest villains of any movie ever. But it is still a pretty straightforward narrative. It doesn't really ever feel disjointed. It doesn't have a lot of as much of the dream logic or dreamy aspects as his other stuff. So that's kind of a middle ground. And then I would say if you really want to dive in and get something that's very Lynch, but not like overwhelmingly Lynch, Mulholland Drive is probably a good starting point as well. It is very disjointed by its nature. It is a neo-noir mystery, but it is a little bit easier to follow if you really pay attention to the story. And if you watch it, really, after you watch it the first time, if you go back and watch it again, you can really start to kind of click everything into place and start seeing how things are foreshadowing themselves and sort of letting you know what's happening as the story goes. But those are really the best, I think, jumping off points. If you've never seen his stuff, consider starting there, or consider Twin Peaks. The show, the first two seasons are easily digestible. Season 2 gets a little rocky in the middle, but it's still.
Don't even watch the middle of it. It's not worth your time. It's so bad.
But season 1 is gold. And the first episode is an hour and a half, I think, depending on which version of it. If you have never seen Twin Peaks, do not watch the international broadcast version, because that will spoil everything going forward. Just watch the pilot episode and keep moving from there. And that's a good jumping off point as well. I think it's got a lot of his weirdness, his surrealism, his quirky characters, and they're smaller episodes, but there's a lot more of them. So that's something to consider. Let's just kind of start at the beginning of his filmography and just kind of talk about these films. So Eraserhead, famously his first movie, He made it while he was in art school and spent a very long time making it. I don't remember the specific amount of time that passed, but there is essentially, I think there's a shot of Jack Nance's character, the main character, Henry, walking into a door, opening the door from one side, and then another shot of him coming into the door that are separated by like 7 years or something. So that kind of gives you an idea of how long he spent working on this film and putting it together. It is a strange one, and he's referred to it as his most spiritual film. Mm-hmm. Something about Lynch, for those who aren't familiar with his work, much like Pynchon, you can really walk away with a lot of different interpretations of what's going on in these films, and none of them are really wrong or right. It's a very subjective experience when you're watching these films, so don't feel bad if you read a review or something, like someone talking about it, and you didn't come away with the same feeling that they have. These films are entirely, and Lynch has said this numerous times throughout his career, these films, he refuses to explain what they mean, so it's entirely up to you as a viewer to decide what's going on. So Eraserhead is the story of a man who lives in a industrial wasteland, essentially, and ends up,
which is meant to represent Philadelphia,
the really shitty side of Philadelphia, and impregnates his girlfriend, and ends up marrying her and meeting her weird family, and they have a baby that is, it's a thing, it's a something, it's, no one has ever been able to figure out
that it was found nearby.
Yeah, no one's ever been able to figure out what he made this model of. There are all kinds of theories, whether it was some kind of an animal fetus or if he just built it. But this baby is a part of their lives now, and it is constantly driving them apart and keeping them up and creating chaos in their lives. And Henry's attempts to deal with it just sort of start to derail his own life. And it just, everything falls apart for him by the third act. It's entirely black and white. There is very little dialogue. I don't think any dialogue.
There's like no dialogue for the first 10 minutes and then like the last half hour.
Yeah, it's a lot of just ambient noise, and it's a very claustrophobic film. It always has you feeling kind of tense that something's going to happen, but it's just kind of hovering there. Very Kafka-esque. And it it's his shortest film. I don't even think it's an hour and a half. I think it's only like 80 minutes or something.
75 maybe.
Yeah. It famously has the In Heaven song. You may have heard of, the Pixies did a famous cover of it. Mm-hmm. It's popped up in random places here and there. And this is the film that really put him on the map. It got the attention of Mel Brooks and helped move him into doing The Elephant Man. Stanley Kubrick had the cast and crew of The Shining watch this film repeatedly to get in the right headspace for making that film. It's been parodied a lot in a lot of different pop culture, so you've probably seen some part of it referenced somewhere. It remains one of my favorite of his films. It's not one that I will go and rewatch as much as some of his other stuff, but it still holds a really special place in my heart and is a really interesting and pleasurable film to watch, just especially for someone who, this was his first film, and you know, pretty much every aspect of this was him, had his hands on it. The music had him, he was working on the sound design, he was doing the cinematography, he was doing a ton of stuff and would always do this with all of his films. So this is the world's introduction to Lynch.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, it was purposely released initially as a midnight movie. Like, no one was supposed to really have seen it. And it just sort of spread by word of mouth, and especially by the directors who started praising it. It's very also weird that this movie attracted George Lucas to offer him Return of the Jedi.
Oh, yeah. which, thankfully, he did not take.
There is a video, too, of him recounting that offer from George Lucas, and it's a monologue of his that he did at like a press event or a convention or something, that you can watch on YouTube, and he's getting like an escalatingly bad migraine the longer that George Lucas is talking to him. And like, he starts getting physically ill towards the end of it. To what degree all of that is true or he was just embellishing, I don't know, but it's very funny.
Yeah, I have struggled over the years to try and imagine what David Lynch's Return of the Jedi would look like.
Importantly, though, of course, it did lead to The Elephant Man, which is certainly a movie we've sort of already talked about. But it is a pretty incredible film. And very strange that he would go from Eraserhead to that. But probably wouldn't have had the rest of his career if he hadn't made that, because of the fact that, like you said, it did garner him, you know, 7 or 8 Oscar nominations. And I think it's the only one of his movies that is in the top 250 on IMDb as well. Maybe Mulholland Drive is as well, but it is widely considered an excellent film just in general, not even amongst David Lynch's filmography in particular.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like of all of his work, maybe The Straight Story is the exception to this, but I feel like The Elephant Man is the one that gets forgotten the most.
Yeah.
And people always kind of talk about Dune being his first and only studio film that we'll get to that when we get to that. But Elephant Man was a studio film. It wasn't as big as a lot of other big blockbuster films from the time, because that was 1980. And it had a big cast. It had a big budget. It was distributed by Paramount and brought in a pretty big box office return. So this was really his first experience working with a sort of within the studio environment, which he would famously go on to really disown and stay away from for the most of the rest of his career, Dune notwithstanding.
But yeah.
Elephant Man is a beautiful film. It really is. And it's kind of a shame that it gets lost in the rest of his work, because his portrayal, like I said earlier, of Joseph Merrick is so touching, and it's just a beautiful thing to watch. And the performances are incredible. It's a huge leap from Eraserhead to this, as far as his growth as a director. And in only 3 years, to see how far he was able to go as far as his technical skill and his ability to put a film together was incredible. And it's one that I would really encourage a lot more people to watch, especially fans of his, to see this kind of earlier examination of characters that he was really, really good at doing.
Yeah, truly. That does, funny enough, though, bring us directly to Dune. And I know you read the book on the production of this movie. So
I did, yeah.
I'll let you take that, because I have yet to read that. But at some point, I would like to.
The book, let me pull up the name of it, because I don't
Masterpiece in Disarray, right?
Masterpiece in Disarray, yes. Thank you. David Lynch was brought on in 1984 to direct the first adaptation of Dune. It's something. So this is really Lynch's first experience working with a big studio and really getting the Hollywood studio experience. And based on, I'd kind of had an idea of the history of this before reading the book, but the book is a really good examination of the production of the film. It has a lot of interviews with people involved, both cast and crew. And it even has, at the very end, there's a brief interview he had with David Lynch himself talking about the film, because Lynch famously kind of disowned this one and did not want his name on it, mm-hmm. didn't want anything to do with it, didn't really like talking about it. Essentially, to boil down the whole thing, Lynch had a lot of really big ideas for this film. And Dune had a history of failed adaptions before this anyways. Alejandro Jodorowsky was trying to make one, which there's a really good documentary about that also, if you've never seen that, Jodorowsky's Dune.
That's an amazing documentary.
That would have been wild also. So Lynch, from the get-go, had these kind of larger-than-life ideas about what he wanted to do with this book, and really and truly, his vision of the film could have been pretty good and could have really been a very interesting take on the novel itself. which is famously a very difficult novel to adapt to big screen. However, the studio being the studio, this was back in the 80s when he was working a lot with Dino De Laurentiis. And so there was a lot of compromise that had to be made on Lynch's end. And this included a lot of him not being able to make the production design choices that he wanted to do. He wasn't able to get some of the bigger, more grandiose ideas that he wanted out there. And this all started to kind of hamstring him more and more as the production went on. There was a lot of issues when they were filming in, I think it was in Mexico. There was a lot of issues with injuries and set design failures and all kinds of things that could go wrong, just kept going wrong. And eventually he turned the film in. The studio didn't like what he turned in and made him chop out a whole lot of it, which really upset him to begin with. And then the studio went in and chopped it up even more. It became this whole big back and forth thing of what the studio wanted versus what he wanted. And eventually he just got to the point where he said, you know what, I'm just going to wash my hands of this, take my name off of it. He didn't use the Alan Smithy. I think he used Judas something. I can't remember the name he ended up putting on there. But yeah, he basically just disowned the film.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I watched this not too long ago. I think I watched it early last year. It's not bad, but it's not good either. And I think there's a lot of people, especially in the Lynch community, who will really, really staunchly defend it as being one of his better films, as being better than the recent Dune adaptations that we've got. It's not bad, but it's not something I can go and watch again. It's weird as hell in a good way most of the time, but it feels like it was something that just got put together really slapshod and didn't really have a lot of attention paid to it. And you can tell there are a lot of just issues going on that were plaguing this film and keeping it from really being what it needed to be. That being said, though, it was the first time that that we saw Kyle MacLachlan. So this was the beginning of their working relationship.
Yeah.
Sting shows up and not much. So if you've ever been curious about most of Sting's body, it's there.
He was originally supposed to be naked when they shot that.
The
studio freaked out and was like, no, you have to put something on him. And so they came up with that weird thong thing in like an hour before
Futurama
they shot
underwear
the movie. Yeah.
It's a trip. The special effects are really cool, especially considering the time that they were done in. The soundtrack is cool. It's weirdly enough by Toto. Brian Eno did a lot of the ambient work on the soundtrack. It's a film that there's a good film in there. It's just never going to see the light of day. If Lynch had been able to do the way he wanted to do, it probably would have been better. Not maybe his best work ever, but it would have been better than what we got. And it's one that I'm not going to go back to it a lot, but I will watch it from time to time. It's a fun movie.
Yeah, it is fun. You can't, as stupid as this sounds, you can't expect everything to make total logical sense the whole time.
Yeah.
Because again, hours was cut out of it. As far as I'm aware, the only reason Lynch agreed to do the film is because they initially told him he'd have final cut and like a lot of resources on it. And just slowly those resources got, you know, pushed around and taken away from him.
Yeah.
Especially as it got more and more expensive to produce, because didn't they have to hand clear like 20 square miles of desert or something like that for the shooting of it? Yeah, it's just crazy expensive movie. But, you know, if you've read the book and you really enjoy the book and you know the storyline, there are some changes from the book, but more or less you could fill in the gap. And it's still, it's still an enjoyable film to make, because there's a level of absurdity to it in a lot of cases that adds, you know, an underlayer of comedy to the whole thing. It's enjoyable. It's not the worst thing ever, but definitely not something that I often think about or want to return to watching.
Yeah. But it did afford him a very important lesson in, this is why I don't want to work with the studios anymore. And I'm going to just do what I want to do, and I'll find a way to make it work. And as a result of that, we ended up getting the Lynch that we would know going forward. So part of what, to kind of divert from going through the filmography for a second, part of what I've always really loved about his work is his unflinching willingness to just do what he wants to do. He never seemed to care about how are people going to react to this film? How are the critics going to see this film? How is my fandom going to view this film? It was always just a matter of, this is the film I want to make. This is how I'm going to do it. And if you like it, you'll like it. If not, too bad. I made it, and there it is. And I mean, famously, to the point where when Lost Highway came out, and Siskel and Ebert gave it two thumbs down, he put that on the release poster, two more reasons to go see this film. So if anything, you know, Dune was a failure in one sense, but I think it really helped him find himself as a director and as an artist. And that led to Blue Velvet, which is probably his most well-known film. It's a neo-noir film that really plays with those conventions. It's a kind of an earlier example of the neo-noir genre. And you mentioned earlier at the top of the episode about how it really is examining the darkness that lies under the veneer of the American dream, so to speak. Do you kind of want to talk about, kind of go through the film?
Yeah, I don't want to. It's a ride. in many ways, and it does have a performance, particularly by the actor portraying Frank Booth, that would revitalize his career prior to that movie coming out. Nobody wanted to cast Dennis Hopper in anything.
He kind of had a reputation at that point. So.
He did, and then finally that movie came out, and that really gave his career a second wind. So he's the standout performance in the film, but really there's no bad performances in it. Isabella Rossellini's really great. Kyle MacLachlan in his second movie ever is really great, and it's a demanding role from him. And it the strength of those performances really can guide you through some of the more turbulent portions of the movie, in the sense that you can appreciate at least like the effort that is being put into the writing and the acting in the film. But it to not spoil too much, Kyle MacLachlan returns home to the town from whence he was grown, and finds a severed ear in a field, and that leads him on a haunting, escalating nightmare trip involving multiple women, a insane person, a guy dressed in a yellow suit, and a lot of other elements that weave until it reaches a fever pitch that does truly feel like you are experiencing a night terror. It's an incredible film, and one that, again, like I mentioned kind of at the top of the show, has a easy enough to understand central message or central series of messages and themes that anybody is going to be able to understand kind of what David Lynch is trying to say from the beginning all the way through the end of the film. Like, that's not going to be too difficult. And the kind of dream logic elements of it, or those moments where something just south of reality happens, really just ends up leading to tone rather than theme. In some of his later work, that balance would kind of shift, but in this it's all the tone he's going for, and it's truly an experience unlike any other film that I've watched. I know that when I first saw this movie, it had a massive impact on me, because prior to watching this movie, I didn't know that from a creative angle, as far as whether you're a director or writer or whatever, that you could just sort of do things, for lack of a better term. Like, you could just put an element in the film that you didn't need to explain, or that didn't need to necessarily provide anything else but tone or atmosphere to, or to kind of put your viewer on edge. There is a scene in the movie in which a character wearing a yellow suit has been shot, killed, and instead of falling, his body it just stays upright in the house.
So fucked up.
It's so strange. And then this scene plays out afterwards where people are running and navigating around his body until eventually someone shoots him. Dennis Hopper's character shoots him a second time, and then his body falls over, as if like he needed more momentum to fall, or that he somehow died at like a perfectly balanced angle. And there's no explanation as to why. There's no indication what that may mean. It's just a thing that happens in that scene that lends this incredibly strange, eerie feeling through the entire thing, on top of the situation itself, which is already sort of dangerous enough for Kyle MacLachlan's character. And that was really the first moment where I was like, oh my God, you can just do stuff like that, and you can be as surreal as you want to be, as you know, your art wants to be, you know, or demands to be in the case of someone like Lynch, in order to be made, and how that can still be a viable thing that like a lot of people are interested in. That was really like a big thing for me and influenced a lot of the creative stuff that I do, as far as, you know, taking risks or getting weirder with, you know, what I was working on, which has always been just a great like centering point for me too, if I ever need some inspiration or to get back to that feeling. And then even funnier later in my life, when I finally discovered like David Foster Wallace and his writing, and it became as influential and meaningful to me, there's an interview that he does with Charlie Rose where he brings up the same feature of Blue Velvet to him. And that was another just cool moment in my life where I was like, hey, I like the same scene from Blue Velvet that David Foster Wallace does. Yeah, it's an excellent movie that, while it is a tough watch, is one that I've probably seen more than any other of his.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's a really good one. I really do enjoy it a lot. There's a lot of firsts for Lynch as far as the recurring motifs and concepts that he uses. Music plays a huge part in this movie, and will in pretty much everything else he does after this.
Yeah.
Where he really will build scenes around a particular song, or he'll literally have the song sung by a character in the film. In Blue Velvet, it's creepy as fuck.
Yep.
It takes Roy Orbison to a place that I don't think Roy Orbison ever thought his music was going to go.
It did kind of ruin his music for me forever.
Yeah,
afterwards.
I can't listen to Roy Orbison without someone having a construction lamp under their face. It's the first time that he worked with Laura Dern, which would go on to be a relationship that they would use. They would work with each other a lot going forward. Same with Kyle MacLachlan. This is the second film that he did with Lynch, but the first Lynch movie that he was in. Dune was the start of his working with Dino De Laurentiis. And this is, I think, where he really started to focus on exposing the darkness that was always kind of lurking under the American veneer, the white picket fence and the roses, which features literally in the first shot of the film. And his examination of that darkness is something that will come up in everything he does after this. And after this is Wild at Heart. This is probably the one I think I've watched the least of all of his stuff.
Other than having not seen Inland Empire, that's the same thing for me too. I think I've seen it one time.
It's not that it's a bad film. This is essentially Lynch's Wizard of Oz.
Is something he's obsessed with. There's an entire documentary just about his obsession with Wizard
Lynch
of Oz,
I think is what it's called.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically if you just decided to make The Wizard of Oz with Nicolas Cage being an unhinged version of Nicolas Cage as an Elvis fan, which he is in real life. But it is one of those instances where Nicolas Cage turns in a really good performance, and I like watching it. And Laura Dern, again, phenomenal in this film. The cinematography is absolutely beautiful. The story is insane. As much as it is a Wizard of Oz tribute, it's still very David Lynch. It's got Willem Dafoe with the world's most fucked up teeth.
Yep, and that's a great Lynch character performance. He has like a couple characters that come up in every movie he makes, whether it be Frank Booth's character in Blue Velvet or the cowboy in Mulholland Drive or the Mystery Man. that Willem Dafoe occupies that role in this movie in a way that is very unhinged.
Really, truly is. Abhi Peru, that was his character's name. Oh, I can just see him slimy ass smile. Oh god.
Yep.
I think it's also a hard one to watch, partially because it's hard to find. It was not on DVD for a very long time. I don't think I've ever come across a copy of it. Anytime I've been anywhere around like used movies or anything like that, it really never pops in anywhere. But it's worth watching. And it may, I know some people in the Lynch fandom consider this their favorite, and that's awesome. It just never really clicked too much with me. But I may need to go back and rewatch it. I think the last time I watched it was probably 15 years ago. So I'm probably due for a rewatch, and maybe my opinion will have changed on it, but
it's also based on a book series. Was something I didn't know until a friend of mine watched it and then said that he got a copy of the book, like the first book in the series that it's based on. So if you really enjoy this film, there is a whole lot more material that you can kind of ingratiate with, to, like, keep that same weird vibe going. I don't really know how to describe the vibe of this movie. It's pretty unique. I have not read them, so I can't vouch for the quality, but it is a thing you can do.
Yeah.
By Barry Gifford.
Barry Gifford, who would go on to co-write Lost Highway with him. And Lost Highway came from the words Lost Highway in that book.
Yeah.
Interesting. They had an interesting working relationship, but I haven't read that book either. I need to at some point.
Yeah. Apparently it's not bad. My friend Zach thought it was pretty good.
Yeah. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's 6 sequels to that book.
Yeah. There's a lot of them. That brings us to Twin Peaks, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. And I'm wearing my Twin Peaks shirt right now. So Twin Peaks, this actually, I think, is probably Lynch's most well-known work outside of Blue Velvet. And really the one that the mainstream is the most familiar with. That being said, the mainstream American viewer did not stay on board for long because this is a David Lynch film or work.
No, it's because you had to watch James play guitar. That series.
That fucking song. Well, okay. So Twin Peaks, for anyone who is not familiar with it, show aired from 1990 to 1991. It was on, I think, CBS. And it ostensibly is about the murder of the homecoming queen in a very small town in the Pacific Northwest and the sort of mystery that surrounds that, who killed her. This was sort of the underpinning theme for the whole show, and this was what brought a lot of people in to continue watching the show. Really, what Lynch was doing, Lynch and Mark Frost, I should say, because they created the show and wrote it together, this was a character examination piece. The show was always just meant to be, look at these weird characters in this small, weird town, and let's kind of examine their lives, and in the background, we'll tie all this together with the murder of this homecoming queen. And unfortunately, what ended up happening is ABC just, you know, did network TV thing and said, no, you have to tell who killed her. And they did that in the second season. And then pretty much everyone jumped ship. The show just went off the rails for half the second season. And Lynch and Frost both kind of just left to go make Wild at Heart. And it really, the show never truly recovered in the sense that it never really had the same mainstream appeal. When Lynch and Frost came back at the tail end of the season, it became stylistically like the first season and the first part of the second season. But by then, the cast was alienated, the audience was alienated, and it all just kind of fell apart. And so it wouldn't be for about 25 years that there would be any resolution, if you could call the return resolution, to the story. But Twin Peaks is a personal favorite of mine, despite its flaws. I absolutely love the characters in the show. Dale Cooper is probably one of my favorite characters of any medium, period.
Yeah.
He is a fascinating, just character to watch. His interactions with these people, his his sort of hyper intelligent aloofness. It's a weird thing to say, but that's, I mean, he really is. He is the typical like good old boy, but just like he's a sweet little puppy with a really, really sharp detective mind. And mm-hmm. his interactions with the people of this town and the other people in this town are just so fun to watch. And it was really, it is heartbreaking how bad that show falls apart in the second season, because it's really had so much going for it. Yeah. And generally when I rewatch the show, I will stop around like episode 13, 14 and then skip to about 20 just to, when Wyndham Earl comes into the picture is really what it, when it picks back up and becomes itself again.
Yep. You know, the thing about Twin Peaks, like maybe I have a different opinion of Twin Peaks than a lot of people do, because it is, I do love it. It is excellent. But I think, unfortunately, maybe about half of the episodes that were ever produced are worth watching, in my opinion. The entirety of season one is really great. The first like four episodes of season two, or maybe six, are really great. And then the last nine are really great when Wyndham or however long that arc is. I don't exactly remember the episode quantity of season two. And then season three is probably about twice as long as it needs to be for me. It's just a lot of Dougie. and there didn't need to be that much Dougie, even slightly. And so what all of my point is the thing that I've always loved about Twin Peaks and the fact that it did have like this temporary moment of mass market appeal, even though it is a fucking weird show. It is tough to imagine a show with those supernatural elements succeeding in America currently on basic cable in the way that it did back in the 90s. It's very impressive mm-hmm. that they were able to pull that off, and it's really neat to me to think about the fact that that was possible in America at one point. I don't know if that happens again if you re-release Twin Peaks without any sort of cultural context behind who David Lynch is and all that. And I think what really makes it work is you had David Lynch, who excelled at the weird paranormal dreamy stuff, and then you had Mark Frost, who had a long history of TV production, and I believe he worked on Law and Order, and you know, understood how to do like procedural stories that are kind of soap opera-esque, you know, characters and situations, which is really what Twin Peaks is. It's a soap opera with like occultism as its center.
Aleister Crowley made a soap opera.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's the union of those two features that really makes Twin Peaks what it is at its best. Mm-hmm. And when it's only one of them instead of two of them, I find that Twin Peaks gets too much of one way or too much of the other way. Because when David Lynch left, when they were writing season two, Mark Frost with no David Lynch, you get the really, really boring mid portion of season two. And then in season three, I know Mark Frost's name is on it, but I don't see where his influence was. And it really is
definitely had to wheel more for sure.
Yeah, it really is just a 12-hour David Lynch movie. And turns out that, at least for me anyway, 12 hours of any director is going to net you about half amazing material and half material that is either unnecessary or just too much. And there are still episodes of season three that like really will blow you away. Season eight in particular, when David Lynch figures what the first nuclear test did like psychically to the world is incredible and almost Pynchonian in certain elements.
It might be one of my favorite episodes of any television show ever.
It is truly phenomenal. Incredible. And the way that he configures like the birth of evil as the result mankind's meddling is just it's amazing. But then you have long ponderous scenes of Dougie just working out how to be a human being that don't need to be there. And I find the ending really satisfying. I know that at the ending of season three was divisive at best. But yeah, it's a show that I love, and it's a show that I love despite its flaws. But I do admittedly, if I ever do a rewatch, I just skip the stuff that I don't particularly enjoy. I pick it up after all that stuff ends.
I gotcha. I watched it when it aired, and the Dougie stuff, yeah, I definitely, for the first little while, was like,
that was tough week to week, because I got a Showtime subscription just to watch it.
I did too,
I'm paying for this, and I got to wait another week before I get more of, hopefully, stuff like episode 8.
But the buildup, by the time when that resolves, is the payoff is great. I went back and rewatched it like a year after it aired, and I was a lot more on board with the Dougie stuff. I think knowing what he was trying to do and where it was going, it's still a lot of it. And I would kind of watch like one or two episodes at a time and then put it away for a little bit and then come back to it and, you know, back and forth on that. But I'm with you on the ending. The ending was very satisfying. I felt like Lynch and Frost found the best way to end that series. And I know it upset a lot of people, and I get it, but to me,
there was no world where everyone was happy.
Exactly. On the flip side, though, the prequel Fire Walk With Me, famously flopped. So
huge, what happened, big time.
Yeah. Well, because what happened was everybody was used to the sort of filtered David Lynch that you were getting in Twin Peaks, because Mark Frost, as you mentioned, was adding a lot of that procedural drama stuff, and obviously he's on network TV, so there's restraints from that. And then Fire Walk With Me comes out, and Lynch just was like, you know what, we're going all in, and I'm going to do this. So originally, the film was originally supposed to be a trilogy of films that were going to examine different parts of the Black Lodge. And when the first one failed, they had to kind of scrap that, and they brought parts of that back for the return and tied that into Fire Walk With Me. But there was supposed to be a lot more. I just rewatched Fire Walk With Me today, and it might be my favorite Lynch film after rewatching it. It is such an ambitious project, and one that I think really distills everything that I loved about Twin Peaks into this 2.5 hour nightmare. And yeah, I think I get why people were upset when it came out, because it wasn't the weird, quirky Dale Cooper and, you know, Andy and Sheriff Truman and all them. They're all gone. There's so many new characters, and the whole film is centered on the last days of Laura Palmer. And my God, Cheryl Lee should have gotten an Oscar nomination at the very least.
I still can't believe she didn't.
She is phenomenal in that film. And it is so heartbreaking to watch that movie. And I know I was reading some interviews with her about the film, and she was talking about how the film did really well in Japan. And that's where she started seeing a lot of people who were victims of rape and incest that were coming to her and saying, this is something that I needed. This has been very cathartic for me to experience. And I think a lot of people missed out on that. And I think because they were so focused on wanting more of the weirdness, that they really just kind of missed the point of, this film is an examination of this very, very dark entity that has taken over. I don't want to spoil anything, but has taken over Twin Peaks and has taken the form of somebody within the town and is abusing Laura. And it's heartbreaking to watch. And the performances from everybody in this film are so, so good. And it is really a shame that it got the reputation it got, because truly, this is Lynch just firing on all cylinders. The cinematography is beautiful. The sound design is incredible. And it really makes for a haunting experience when it needs to be a haunting experience. And the ending is so goddamn beautiful and just crushing to watch, but very cathartic at the same time. And I find myself every time I watch it, I'm just in tears by the end of it. And it really deserves way more attention than it's gotten over the years.
Yeah. It's hard to describe what it's like to watch the movie, especially because it kind of jumps around a lot in the beginning and the end really kind of laser focuses in on Laura, but every element of that movie just works so well for me. And even though you do initially get a degree of confusion because you're introduced to Chet Desmond instead of Dale Cooper, you find your footing with it really fast. And while it doesn't feel exactly like the show, it feels enough like the show that you can see its relation. But it does allow Lynch to explore the supernatural elements of the show in much greater detail, which is crazy for me to say because there's like 2 minutes above the garage, which is where a lot of that comes from. Evidently, that scene was originally 20 minutes, and they cut it down to the like two that appears. But that sequence is one of the most unsettling things that I think I have ever seen on first sort of viewing. It's crazy, and it effectively tells you what the rest of the film is going to feel like. Because even when it gets into the domestic stuff and everything that was going on with Laura that led to her death at the beginning of the show, that sort of element of fear or unsettledness just doesn't go away. And I famously, this is the really long take of Laura staring at the ceiling is in this movie, right? Mm-hmm. And that scene is just, like, as a depiction of disassociation, like, it's crazy how effective this movie is at communicating with such obtuse imagery at times. It's an incredible film. It is certainly one of my favorites. I don't know if it is my favorite overall. I'd have to go back and watch it again. It's been a while. But it's also the household that I live in is very divided. my partner hates this movie because in her mind she said it's tough and a lot, which is both just true. But for her that ruins the experience of watching it. And she's a really big Twin Peaks fan. And then for me, it's up there at the highest for me because it also does fill in, you know, details that people wanted to know. Part of the reason why Lynch wanted to make the movie in the first place was because people were asking him what different spiritual elements of it meant or if they were ever going to get any kind of answers on that. And he provided them, and he did them in a way that didn't talk down to the audience in a way that overly spells everything out. He did it in a very effective, creative way.
Mm-hmm. It also has, it has one of the most tense scenes that I've ever seen in a film when Laura and her dad are driving and the one-armed man is behind them and then whips around and turns around and starts yelling at Leland. And the whole time Leland is revving his engine and the one-armed man's, his car is revving up and Laura's freaking out. Like she's taking all of the sensory input in and it's overwhelming to the point of just like I found myself, my fists were clenched.
Yep.
And it's so like, that's the kind of stuff that Lynch is very, very good at, is these visceral feelings in these small scenes. And oh God, I just love that movie.
It's really excellent. That was certainly another scene where the first time I watched it, I was with a friend of mine and like that scene ended and I just went, I breathed a sigh of relief that situation was over.
Yeah. And so then from there, Lynch took kind of, I think just about the longest break he took between that and his next film, Lost Highway. It was 5-year gap in between those two. And Lost Highway, that was actually my first experience with Lynch at all. Mm-hmm. That movie came out in 97. I was a freshman in high school when I saw it. That was 1999. And I bought a VHS copy of it because I knew about the film because I was a really big fan of Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson at the time. And I knew that they were involved in the soundtrack and specifically that Trent Reznor had arranged the soundtrack. And so I sought it out and I remember watching it with my wife at the time. We just started dating. And when the mystery man showed up the first time, she was like, I'm out, I'm done. Just went to another room. And I sat there just absolutely dumbfounded, and the whole film just blew me away. And I've watched it so many times since then. I watched it again yesterday That was the first one I went to when I heard that he had passed. And that movie might be his most visually, not uncomfortable, but distressing. It is incredibly tense throughout the entire film.
Oh, the whole thing. It almost sucks to watch it because of how on edge you are. The scene when the smoke is coming
up the stairwell, like, I still don't know how they did that, but god damn it, that freaks me out so much. Robert Blake's character is one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen in any movie.
Yep.
Again, Lynch gets these performances out of his actors that are unbelievable, and they always just go unappreciated by a lot of critics, and it's a shame. Bill Pullman's great. Patricia Arquette, holy crap, she is incredible in this movie. And yep. Everybody, Balthazar Getty is really good. The last film appearances of Richard Pryor and Jack Nance. The music is phenomenal. The cinematography is phenomenal. This film is essentially, Lynch would go on later, I think it was around 2002 or 3, that he said he realized subconsciously that the O.J. Simpson trial was very influential in making the film. So essentially what the film is about, this man and his wife who receive a package on their doorstep one day. It's a VHS tape. And when they put it in, someone has filmed the outside of their house. And it's unsettling enough as it is, but as time goes on, they get another one and another one. And these videos go on further and further, eventually going into the house and filming them sleeping. And then eventually his wife is murdered. He's accused and found guilty and goes to jail, where he has a complete mental schism. And the film shifts over to this other character and starts to go through his life, which is very similar in that it's involving the same characters and the same female, I guess you could call her a femme fatale, mm-hmm. but they're all different names. They're all kind of slightly askew from what they were. So it's really playing with this identity crisis that he's going through. And Lynch was saying that watching the OJ trial and seeing this man who was essentially almost like two different people was a sort of subconscious influence on the making of this film.
Yeah.
This one is a tough one to watch. I personally love it, but my God, it's incredibly violent. It's incredibly dark. I saw something online yesterday when I had finished watching it, and I was looking up random stuff about it, and I don't remember what online article or whatever, some online blog or something like that did a list of the sexiest scenes in a horror film, and they had Patricia Arquette being forced to strip at gunpoint in there as like number one, which there's nothing sexy about that scene. It's an incredibly distressing scene to watch.
Yeah.
And I really could not figure out what they thought about that was a pleasure to watch, because it's absolutely not.
Yeah, that's disturbing that someone wrote and published that.
Yeah. You know, like I said, that film does a very, very good job of making me feel very uncomfortable at a lot of times, but it is really a experience to watch. And it's one that I will warn people, if you haven't seen it, be prepared, because it is a lot, mm-hmm. Even for Lynch.
Yeah, it's, I don't think I can add anything beyond what you've said, other than, yeah, be aware that it is a lot, but it is really, really powerful in its portrayal of how people can change into completely different people through their actions, essentially, and how the insecurity and shame of that will come back to haunt you no matter mm-hmm. what. It's really something. And it's also maybe the best performance Bill Pullman ever did in his career.
Yeah, probably.
And yeah, like you already said, Robert Blake, but that's a performance that really
lives in your head.
Yeah, really lives in my head as the closest thing that I think I've come to seeing in movies being like inhuman. Mm-hmm. Like, there is something about Robert Blake's performance and incredibly like strained facial features that he has.
He never blinks at all,
and oh god, yeah, it just lives at the back of my brain, not too far from my thoughts usually.
I remember trying to explain the first scene with him to someone and trying to describe how horrible it is, like, not horrible in a bad way, but how horrific it is to watch.
Yeah.
And it does not translate when you just tell someone he meets this guy at a party who calls himself and talks to him while he's in front of him. Doesn't make any sense. But when you watch it, it is one of the most terrifying things I have ever seen in my life.
Yeah. The way that he just walks up out of a regular crowd of people, but then as soon as he appears like in frame next to Bill Pullman, like they've started to conversate, the way that the sound just drops. Dies out.
Yeah.
And instead there is this, it isn't exactly silence, it's like white noise making you feel like things are silent. Mm-hmm. It's weird. Like if you ever put on like noise canceling headphones but don't listen to music, that's yes. the closest kind of tone to like what he's playing behind that encounter. And the first time that I watched the movie, I didn't even realize he had faded the music of the party out until like maybe like 30 seconds to a minute into the scene when the music faded out. And when I noticed it, I was like, haha, it literally freaked me out, which, you know, he uses silence very effectively in mm-hmm. his filmmaking in a way that I think few directors do.
The soundtrack for that film is also phenomenal. There are some
yeah
really good songs on there, both pop songs that were done by Nine Inch Nails and like Rammstein and Smashing Pumpkins might have their best song on there. Is an incredible song. And then the songs that at Bowie, Driver Down is a great song. There are the songs that are done by, I can't think of his name now, the guy that did the score. It wasn't Angelo Badalamenti. He did some of the music on there, but Barry Adamson did some really cool tracks on there as well. And like I said, Lynch's use of music in films is always spot on. And I'm sorry, it wasn't Driver Down that Bowie did. It was I'm Deranged. This is no exception. This is a phenomenal soundtrack, a phenomenal score. Mm-hmm. Just a great, great movie all around. And then somehow he followed that up with The Straight Story, which I think we talked about that a little bit during Vineland.
We did, yeah, I think. I don't know how this came about, actually.
I don't either. It just, I think we were talking about PTSD and vets or something like that when we were talking about the
employees. Oh, yes.
I think that's where we got onto it. This is the essentially true outlier.
What this G-rated movie is.
Yes, so don't let the fact that this is a G-rated movie make you think that it is a walk in the park on a nice sunny day. This is dealing with some really heavy themes, and the performances, once again, Richard Farnsworth, I think this might have been his last film. He, my God, was incredible. And there's a scene with him and I can't remember who else, when he's in the bar talking to the other guy. And this is literally, these two are both vets and they're just talking about their experiences in the war. And it is so raw and powerfully emotional. And it really, on its surface, this is just the story of a guy who drives a tractor from point A to point B to get to his brother's farm before his brother dies. And he wants to spend some time with him. But there is so much more going on. It's really just an examination of how, you know, someone who went through something so traumatic as fighting in a war is dealing with this on a psychological level and the impact that it has on him as a human. And it's another one that I haven't watched as much as I probably should, but phenomenal film and just an incredible set of performances by everyone involved.
Yeah, it's one that's very surprising, and it's an outlier in that there is not much here that smacks of David Lynch.
No.
It's just a movie he happened to direct. I don't know if it was a paycheck thing. I don't know why he did it, but he turned in a very good product. It's a very successful film in the elements about PTSD and sort of life after serving in the military. It's very effective at those themes. And has some sweetness and some like almost cosmic yearning. It's good.
Yeah.
Mulholland Drive, I think, is the next one. Yeah.
Yeah. Straight Story sandwiched in between Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive. Which is a really weird thing.
Mulholland Drive is It's probably my favorite David Lynch movie. It's
a phenomenal film.
Yeah, it, you know, Blue Velvet means more to me, but I would say that it's Mulholland Drive is probably my favorite in that it deals with very real psychological stuff that he kind of always probes, but maybe not fully in depth on one character like he does in this movie, because this movie really only has three people in it from an actual like character count, so he's able to take an extreme focus on that kind of triangle of individuals, and it blends the surreal dreamlike elements, because a portion of this movie is literally a dream, and he's able to use that dream logic to confuse the presentation of the narrative from a standpoint of its chronology, and then, you know, is able to double back on the same themes he's exploring through the dream logic in a really effective way. It's about as close to a platonic ideal of a David Lynch movie as I think you can get.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying in how it portrays its main character as far as the like amount of character work they're able to give her and the kind of development you see in her character and in the degradation of her sanity, really. And it's also a case where someone uses bad acting to support the presentation of the movie in a way that is successful. And I realize that's maybe an obtuse thing to say, but there is a point in this movie in which overacting or bad acting is a part of the reality of the story that you're being told, essentially. Mm-hmm. And to see that play out in a way that isn't overdone and isn't underdone, where you can't tell what he's doing, is incredible, not just from a writing perspective, but also from a performance perspective. You know, we talk about like Patricia Arquette or Dennis Hopper or Robert Blake or Bill Pullman. Naomi Watts' performance in this movie is incredible from a perspective of what it is that she has to do between the sort of like fake slight overacting to the like mix of emotions that she has later in the film to like the actual degradation that she goes through from her mental state towards the very end of the film. It is really a performance that, again, deserved an Oscar nomination and didn't get one.
Unbelievable.
And there are other, it's the best performance I think that I've ever seen by Justin Theroux in anything.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
His performance as the director, both in the dream sequence and out of the dream sequence, is so good that you almost can't tell he's supposed to be overacting in the dream sequences. He just sells that character so perfectly. And it also, you know, its depiction of the power structures of society and of this society being Hollywood in a very Pynchonian way. That scene where the company comes to tell Justin Theroux that he's going to have to change actors is very mm-hmm. Pynchonian. And the guy revealing his, you know, pleasure of the espresso with a yes or a no to a business proposition, to just the kind of on edge nature of the scene, and then the way that it goes from that scene to the like studio head going and seeing the man behind a glass wall that's in this strange, like, you know, darkly lit room but has a desk and he's got like an assistant and everything. It's just there's a level to the depiction of like the power structures, or the capital T they, that I love from an actual just like image perspective. It's so good. And it's likely that this is one of David Lynch's more personal films, in the sense that if you read the biography of him that he actually contributed to, he mentions that when he was a boy in Montana, when he was like 7 or 6, he saw a woman just wander out of the woods. And she was like kind of fucked up, but just kept walking. And this was just something that he witnessed happen. And it seems to me that this movie could be just sort of an exploration of how that woman might have gotten there in David Lynch's, you know, 6-year-old head, or however old he was when it happened. It's it's an incredible film, and one that I think it's as close to a platonic ideal of a David Lynch film as you can get.
Yeah, I would completely agree. I rewatched this one. I watched half of it last night up until the cowboy and Adam Kesher met up for the first time, and then
I love that scene.
That is one of my favorite scenes.
Yep.
Yeah, this whole film is just a huge middle finger to the Hollywood structure and the way it treats artists, not just and how
women in particular,
specifically how it treats women. The scene where Betty is auditioning is horrifically uncomfortable to watch, because that is so close to being a casting couch situation, just with other people watching.
Yep.
And it's just gross to know that that's what goes on. And then seeing the film be taken out of the hands of the director, to the point where he can't even decide who's in his film.
Yep.
The suit guy that controls everything and is running everything behind the scenes, which took me until I think my third time watching it to realize that that was Michael J. Anderson in a large bodysuit. And that the espresso guy was Angela Badalamenti.
Yeah.
I love those little details that he throws in there. And yeah, it is an incredibly disturbing film to watch. How it is punctuated with a lot of really funny scenes, though. The scene with the hitman.
Oh my God. That's bumbling so through
trying to just
funny.
Kill one guy. It's so good. And then it's countered by.
He kills the witnesses. He shoots the vacuum, and that starts a fire.
Come on.
It's so funny.
Just the exasperation that he goes through in trying to do one simple thing. Oh my God!
Yeah.
But then there's scenes like the person behind the dumpster at the Winkies is one of the most terrifying things. Not having been prepared for that the first time was bad enough, but rewatching it, I know it's coming, and it's still.
It's
the way
awful.
He builds that tension is so palpable.
It's awful.
Just that slow walk back there, and then cutting to the dumpster, and then cutting back, and then cutting back, and cutting back, and it. Oh God!
Yeah.
And then the scene with the cowboy is really unsettling. Just phenomenal performances all around. Laura Herring was great in her role. It's especially like you mentioned this idea of them. The way that they do those performances and overperforming specific parts and then and then reverting to a very more natural, real performance. But at the same time, they're also playing two characters.
Yeah.
And it is such a balancing act. And again, the lack of appreciation that the actors get from the studios and the critics and everything is appalling. These are some phenomenal performances. And the fact that Naomi Watts wasn't even nominated is unbelievable. And this is, I can say with certainty, the only movie with Billy Ray Cyrus that I like. I don't know if it's his only film ever, but it's certainly the only one that he's in that I like.
Yeah, that is a crazy just appearance. I rewatched this last night with a friend of mine who'd seen nothing of David Lynch's, but had wanted to start watching his movies. And then when I mentioned that he had passed yesterday, he was like, okay, do you want to watch one of them? Which one do you want to watch? And so I picked Mulholland Drive. And when it got to the Billy Ray Cyrus scene, he was laughing his ass off just because of how random it is for him to show up. And then, like, not be a great actor, but better than you'd imagine he would be.
Yeah, he turned in a fine performance. I was okay with it. Yeah, it is a very, very, very good film. The ending is really a really rough one, but again, a phenomenal performance by Naomi Watts. Once I will say, I think of all of Lynch's everything he's done, I think the Club Silencio scene might be my favorite individual scene of everything he's done.
It's
maybe
really
maybe second
incredible.
To the not the attic, but the upstairs in Firewalk with Me. But Silencio does such a phenomenal job of really explaining everything that has happened and is going to happen in the film in a way that is so obtuse that if you're not really paying attention to what's happening, it doesn't mean anything other than this is a really cool scene. It looks cool, but it is so well filmed and so well put together and it just is mind blowing. I could watch that scene on repeat all day. It Rebecca Del Rio's cover of Roy Orbison again,
yep.
Of his song "Crying" is one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard, and it's just a complete a cappella version in Spanish of Roy Orbison's "Crying," but it's hauntingly beautiful.
Yeah, it's really entrancing as well. Like when she eventually dies on stage, and then the music keeps playing, mm-hmm. the way that he is like so fully convinced you that this was not lip syncing, and the way that
despite just telling you beforehand that none
exactly.
of it is real,
yeah, and then the way that he goes from like through the sheer like rawness of that vocal performance of you. In some context, you know, being moved to very heavy emotion for her to just die, it really does a number on the in a way that few movies can in that short of a space. It's great. And then, like you said, the fact that it is that scene is essentially a tableau of what the whole movie is about thematically is really impressive as well.
And I think that was famously the only Lynch movie that Roger Ebert liked.
I think you're right about that. Yeah.
I know for sure he hated Blue Velvet and would never come yep. around to it, which his take on that was so fucking stupid, whatever. Even Isabella Rossellini shot him down with his whole like, oh, this is a misogynist movie.
Yep. There's a misogynist character, but it's not a misogynist movie.
So that brings us to Inland Empire. And I did a whole bonus episode on this film. This is Lynch's last film, unless you want to count The Return. Twin Peaks: The Return as a film. This is definitely his most experimental film. I go through it a lot more in depth on the bonus episode. So if you want to go find that, it will cover a lot more of it. But this was a film that he shot entirely on a handheld digital video camera in 2007. There was no 2006, excuse me. There was no shooting script whatsoever. He was literally writing these scenes day to day and just kind of letting things come to him and work it all out as he was going. It's a brutally unsettling film to watch because of the way it was filmed. It is very grainy by its nature. It's very, everything is close up shots. It's a lot of just real tight in on characters. And much like Mulholland Drive, it is doing this whole very dreamlike way that everything is. So the dialogue sounds very stilted at times and very unnatural. And that's mm-hmm. entirely by design. Laura Dern, this might be her greatest performance in anything ever. She is unbelievably phenomenal in this film. And again, essentially playing, I think in this, she's really playing three characters. And I think people have a hard time understanding how hard it is to act acting, but she does such a good job of that throughout this film. Again, sound design is phenomenal. The camera work, it's going to be a tough one if you've never seen it before. Number one, it's 3 hours long. I think three. Yep. 15.
One of the first movies to really be that in the 21st century.
Yeah. It is early P.T. Anderson length, and it's very hard to watch just in a literal sense. It is shaky camera work. I noticed in rewatching Mulholland Drive yesterday and today, the camera is never still. It's always moving, which mm-hmm. gives it that dreamy quality that it has. And it's the same with Inland Empire, but ratcheted up just because of the handheld nature of it. And again, phenomenal performances all around. The music is great. Lynch did a lot of the music himself for this one. And it's very similar to Mulholland Drive and Lost Highway in the story that it's telling. This is on its surface a cursed film story where the main character is starring in this film whose production is cursed going back decades. And they've been trying to kind of find a way to remake it and make it happen. And it just keeps having things happen to its actors and crew and everything. And so she takes it on and eventually falls so into the role that she cannot distinguish between her life and the life of her character. And it all bleeds together so much that the viewer has no idea at certain points what is going on and who's who, what part of it's real, what part of it isn't real, until the end. And it has a similar sort of rug pull moment, like the Silencio scene from Mulholland Drive, that really kind of shakes you up as a viewer, especially the first time. I was lucky enough to see this when it came out. I drove up to Austin to go see it. And I wanted to mention this story because this ties into what happened yesterday. So I went with a friend of mine. I did not ask him if he wanted to go. I mentioned that I was going to Austin to see this film. And he just was like, yeah, I'll go with you. Whatever. we had a great trip going up there. He hated me for taking him to this movie. He's never liked Lynch. I don't know why he went with me knowing I was going to see a David Lynch film, but that's beside the point.
You told him at least that much then, huh?
I did. I was like, I'm going to see Inland Empire. You know, if you want to come, that's fine, but know what I'm going to see. He's been one of my best friends I've known him as long as I've known my wife. Like, she introduced me to him. He's a great guy. And so he would always, in the time since then, since 2007, almost every time I would see him, we would joke about that experience and how much he held it against me that I dragged him to see this 3-hour film that he was bored through. And I was furiously taking notes on a napkin at the Alamo Drafthouse. And he's the one that texted me yesterday about Lynch's passing. And let me pull it up real quick, because he's like I said, he's one of my best friends. And it shows through what he sent me. It says, David Lynch passed away. And while I will never forget that horrible day you put me through, I know what he means to you. All the love.
Mm.
And it, needless to say, you know, this is why we're doing this episode. This was a big loss for a lot of people. This one hurt me a lot. I don't think I've been as impacted by a celebrity passing away since Bowie died. And I think this one hit even a little harder just because of how much Lynch's films have meant to me for as long as they have meant a lot to me, and how much he has shaped me as a creative person. So that really like sucked all of the air out of my day yesterday. And I really just struggled to get through the rest of the workday and to just not think about that. And so going back and watching Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive and Firewalk with me today, and I'm going to watch more of his stuff in the coming days, has been really good. This conversation has been a lot for me. Like, this has been very cathartic to mm-hmm. have someone that I can talk to that's on the same level and appreciates his work on the same level that I do. So I do thank you for that, for doing this with me. It's the world is never going to be the same again. There are filmmakers who inspired Lynch. Obviously, people like Buñuel and Dali were huge influences on him. Jodorowsky. But Lynch always had way more. I think he cared more about his characters. He cared more about his actors as human beings than any of them. And his ability to show the beauty that exists even in the darkest of situations and the darkest of stories is something that I've carried with me for most of my life at this point. There's never been an artist, I don't think, that has really been that impactful in that sense for me as David Lynch has. So while he's gone, obviously his art will always be with us. And I really was hoping for at least something else from him, but I
especially with how many different news stories were like circulating about him working on like a show and then another movie. And then with the, you know, sudden worsening of his emphysema. Like that was,
my God, the man smoked a lot of cigarettes.
He smoked a lot of cigarettes for a long time.
I think he started when he was 10.
Yeah. Like, man smoked for 68 years.
Yeah.
Or something crazy like that. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's a tough loss, and it's weird for me to consider a world where David Lynch isn't alive, as strange as that sounds.
I know. I'm looking at I have his Wikipedia page up right now, and I don't like seeing died on there. Fucking sucks.
He would just randomly appear every once in a while. Like, I remember when the ALS ice bucket thing was going on, he did it out of nowhere. Yeah. I don't think even anyone asked him to. And then he did it with just a shot of espresso instead of like a bucket of ice. And then nominated 5 other people. And then, like, you know, during COVID, he popped up by doing weather reports, or he would just look out the window of his office and then tell you what it looked like.
But there was always this undercurrent of just sincere goodness in him.
Yeah, he's like everyone's grandpa.
Yeah. I've never heard an actor or an actress or anyone who worked with him have anything bad to say about him. And it's always been just glowing, heartfelt reviews of his work. And especially after his passing, you know, Laura Dern and Naomi Watts and Kyle MacLachlan have all come out and talked about him. And especially in a time where we're seeing more and more of these people come to light as these monsters, it's so nice to have someone who was just a pure heart at his core. Yeah. And, you know, genuinely cared about people.
Yeah, truly. He did, I remember, and it, you know, for those who don't know, he did a lot of music video work that's worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of short films that are also worth watching. He was also a big painter, like when he was originally in college. That was what he went to school for. He wanted to become a painter and continued painting for the entirety of his life while he was doing his films. There was an exhibition of some of his work at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, in 2022 that I got to go see. And even that is, like, impressive. Like, he was such a force creatively in, like, everything that he attempted to do. And it's, he was such a unique voice. He was a unique voice that was not at all afraid to be entirely himself. He had no interest in deluding himself for any reason or for any project. Just didn't interest him. That was why he put a pseudonym on Dune. That wasn't his movie. And for him to be able to turn out products that were exactly his vision, that were exactly everything he wanted them to be, and to have that be maybe not commercially viable, but seen as important enough to fund the production of, is a huge thing. And with his loss, we lose another filmmaker with a very unique voice who was seen as important enough to release the work of, even if it didn't make its money back. And there are less and less of those directors and artists around than ever before. And yeah, much like David Bowie, it's not right that voice isn't around anymore.
Yeah, and if you've watched all of his films and you want to see more of his other art, there was a few documentaries that came out when he was making some of his films. Pretty as a Picture came out when he was doing Lost Highway, and that features a lot of his paintings, and he was designing furniture for the film as well. So a lot of that is in there, and he walks through his creative process, and it's really fascinating to watch that. Same with when he was filming Inland Empire, there was a documentary called Lynch One that kind of walked through the making of that film. These are not typical, like, behind the scenes documentary kind of things. It's still very much David Lynch. Lynch One has a whole, I think, 10 or 15 minutes dedicated to him making quinoa.
It's great. You can just watch it's David phenomenal. Lynch cooks quinoa, and he tells a funny story from his life.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. The man, like I said earlier, his sense of humor is like no one else. It's really just so weird and out there, and I love it, and it shaped a lot of my own humor. I'm glad we could get together and talk about it. I wish it wasn't for this reason, but the world has lost a true visionary and a true artist, but at least we have his art. At least we have his contributions.
Yeah, very true.
Well, I think that'll do it for this. For those who are following along with the regular show, well, we had to split our chapter 9 and 10 episodes up because we made a firewalk with me, and we made a 5.5 hour episode.
Yeah,
on two chapters, and so we had to split those up. So this episode I'm gonna put this out as soon as we can, and just to have it in, you know, in a timely manner, and then we'll be back with our chapter 10 episode on the 31st of this month. And then our wrap-up episode after that. The details on that wrap-up episode will be in the Chapter 10 episode. We're really excited about that one. So thank you all so much for listening. Go watch some David Lynch movies or go watch Twin Peaks. Celebrate the man's life, celebrate his art, and get out there and make your own. I don't think there's any better artist out there to inspire creativity than David Lynch.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you at all.